Now, I think I'll take it that those thoughts are generally okay. Is that all right? And I'll be now defining them in relation to two models of law, and then you can come in with questions that may be emerging. Let me present to you first the first model of law in which the transcendence and immanence of God are present, in which the revelation of God is said to occur, and the Torah is an inspired statement of God's will. So all those words are relevant here. And this model is the one I see the Pharisees following. And you may find it particularly attractive yourself, and if so, you've got lovely people with you, like the Pharisees, like Paul, before his conversion. God is, in this model, the transcendent God, of course. But God is also immanent in the religious human experience of Moses. God is present in that desert journey. God is present in the climbing of the mountain. God is present in the thunder and the lightning. And God is present in whatever Moses enacts as a result of that encounter with God. On the mountain, God revealed himself to Moses in an ineffable way. But, and here's the key of this model, God did not just reveal himself. He revealed the Torah. And the law, Greek, English word from the Greek, but let's call it the Torah. The Torah, the way that God revealed to Moses, is exactly the way that Moses wrote it down and revealed it to the people. It was a package deal. And an image for it would be, to change that image of what, it's almost as though God were the typist and Moses was the typewriter. And God went, and Moses, and that's the law, within Hebrew characters. And you could truly say, people, and I would think most of them understood it this way, if the law said it, God said it. It was actually given to God like that, and he wrote it down like that. And they agreed, that many of them, that God didn't reveal everything all at once there. It's like the moon. It's a little sliver of a moon, a slipper, and then it becomes a half moon, and then a three-quarter moon, then a full moon. And God is revealing his face, his law, his will gradually to us, hiding some and revealing others. But whatever God reveals is what the prophet picks up and hands on. Let's examine that model just before we move to the second one and look at it. And I'm just asking myself, and you ask yourself, does it make sense? Does it actually, I mean, many people thought it did, so who am I to immediately deny it? But just let's check it. When you actually look at the laws themselves, or when I look at the laws themselves, I've got references there from Leviticus all the way through, laws, for example, on sacrifices that they were to offer, and laws on the festivals they were to keep, and laws on the sanctuary, Exodus 25 and the following, how it was to be built. One doesn't have to be a sociologist or historian, I don't think, to wonder whether those laws are actually, are they directly revealed by God, or are they the application of the vision of God by a person in a certain social context? Because when you look at them, they seem to belong to nomadic people, and they're about sheep, because there are shepherds there. It all seems, at least, they're terribly relevant to a particular stage of growth of a people. And that isn't the only thought you get, because when you read, and I'll read now for you, Amos chapter 5, for example, he doesn't seem to be taking many of these laws terribly seriously. Let me read you this. This is God speaking through the prophet. So he claimed, I hate and despise your feasts. Well, who commanded them? I take no pleasure in your solemn offerings, your festivals. When you offer me holocausts, I reject your oblations, and I refuse to look at your sacrifices of fattened cattle. Let me have no more of the din of your chanting, no more of your strumming on harps, but let justice flow like water and integrity like an unfailing stream. Did you bring me sacrifice and oblation in the wilderness for all those 40 years, house of Israel? Now, I mean, it may be, but all Amos is objecting to is the way the sacrifices are being offered and the lack of perspective and the fact that they didn't have justice at the heart of them. Yes, but the more you read the prophets, I think there seems to be more going on than that. They seem to be not just talking about perspective. They seem to be objecting to the fascination and the fixation and, well, to the laws themselves when they don't fulfill the Shema, when they aren't in touch with the way. That's arguable, but I'm only giving you a little feel of it there. The next lot, even more frightening. There are laws excluding people from the temple, Leviticus 15, Deuteronomy 23. Foreigners weren't allowed in the temple. Eunuchs weren't allowed in the temple or in the assembly of the people by law. But let me read to you Isaiah chapter 56. Again, it's about justice. It's about the Redeemer God. It's about redemption. And God goes on and says this: let no foreigner who has attached himself to Yahweh say, Yahweh will surely exclude me from the people. And why would a foreigner say that? Because everybody's saying it. Everybody in every synagogue saying, you're excluded from the people. And the prophet gets up and says, let no foreigner say it. Let no eunuch say, I am a dried up tree. For Yahweh says this, Yahweh says this, and this is not in the Torah, to the eunuchs who observe my Sabbaths and resolve to do what pleases me and clings to my covenant, I will give in my house and within my walls a monument and a name better than sons and daughters. I'll give them everlasting name that shall never be effaced. Foreigners who have attached themselves to Yahweh to serve him and to love his name and to be his servants, all who observe the Sabbath, not profaning it, and cling to my covenant, these I will bring to my holy mountain. I'll make them joyful in my house of prayer. Their holocausts and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar, for my house will be a house of prayer for all the peoples. There seems to be a conflict here between that model, which sees, as I'm presenting it, all these various laws, including the exclusion of the foreigner and the exclusion of the eunuch, and laws regarding women, and laws regarding warfare and slavery. Thou shalt not kill, but then there's a list of all the people you can kill. Thou shalt not steal, but there's a whole lot of things you can hoard, as long as they belong to you and not to the other tribal peoples. The more you look at the book of Exodus and the book of Leviticus, I would think the more you come away seeing the enormous wealth of it all, but the limitations of it all. Did God put all that like that, direct, on a typewriter? Or was Moses the typist? Inspired by what he had seen of the mystery of God, he then forges into law, he and his followers forge into law the best way he can see, in the half inspiration as it were, how to live this out in practical circumstances of the daily life of the time. Lastly on this model, Another factor is Jeremiah and Ezekiel and other prophets looking forward to a new covenant, a new law, a law that's going to be written on their hearts. And were they simply talking about a new way of keeping the old law? I don't think so. They seem to be talking about a need for a fuller revelation, a fuller disclosure, a more inspired statement of the mystery of God that they're kind of half seeing and don't find sufficiently expressed in the way, the Torah, that's locked, etched on those bits of stone and locked into those books. And so I present to you perhaps another model.